29th verse of the 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Bhaktaram yagyatapasam sarvalokamaheshwaram suhridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shantim richati. Translation. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material misery. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The conditioned souls within the clutches of illusory energy are all anxious to attain peace in the material world. But they do not know the formula for peace, which is explained in this part of the Bhagavad Gita. The greatest peace formula is simply this: Lord Krishna is the beneficiary of all human activities. Man should offer everything to the transcendental service of the Lord because He is the proprietor of all planets and the demigods thereon. No one is greater than Him. He is greater than the greatest of the demigods, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. In the Vedas, Svetashvatara Upanishad, the Supreme Lord is described as Tam Ishvaranam Paramam Maheshwaram. Under the spell of illusion, living entities are trying to be lords of all they survey. But actually, they are dominated by the material energy of the Lord. The Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in this world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. Lord Krishna is the supreme predominator, and all living entities, including the great demigods, are His subordinates. One can attain perfect peace only in complete Krishna consciousness. This 5th chapter is practical explanation of Krishna consciousness, generally known as Karma Yoga. The question of mental speculation as to how Karma Yoga can give liberation is answered herewith. To work in Krishna consciousness is to work with the complete knowledge of the Lord as predominator. Such work is not different from transcendental knowledge. Direct Krishna consciousness is Bhakti Yoga, and Jnana Yoga is a path leading to Bhakti Yoga. Krishna consciousness means to work in full knowledge of one's relationship with the Supreme Absolute, and the perfection of this consciousness is full knowledge of Krishna, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A pure soul is the eternal servant of God and his fragmental part and parcel. He comes into contact with Maya, illusion, due to desire to lord it over Maya, and that is the cause of his many sufferings. As long as he is in contact with matter, he has to execute work in terms of material necessities. Krishna consciousness, however, brings one into spiritual life even while one is within the jurisdiction of matter, for it is an arousing of spiritual existence by practice in the material world. The more one is advanced, the more he is freed from the clutches of matter. The Lord is not partial towards anyone. Everything depends on one's practical performance of duties in Krishna consciousness, which helps one control the senses in every respect and conquer the influence of desire and anger. And one who stands fast in Krishna consciousness, controlling the above-mentioned passions, remain factually in the transcendental stage of Brahma Nirvana. The Eightfold Yoga mysticism is automatically practiced in Krishna consciousness because the ultimate purpose is served. There is a gradual process of elevation in the practice of yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. But this only prefaces perfection by devotional service, which alone can award peace to the human being. This is the highest perfection of life. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport to the fifth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of karma yoga, or action in Krishna consciousness. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Krishna says here, Bhaktaram Yagya Tapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Suhridam Sarvabhutanam Gyatva Mam Shantirvichati. This fifth chapter is very interesting because it gives us very practical hints of how to act in this world and at the same time to be happy. This particular chapter is dealing with this very essential subject matter of how to be happy, how to remain above karma. Because when we are acting in this world, inevitably we confront so many difficulties. Inevitably we encounter so many different problems which are built in this material nature. Karma is a very entangling thing. You do one thing and then the reaction will come, and then the reaction will come, and then you get addicted to the things. Karma is a vicious circle. And Krishna explains this. Krishna says that when you get attached to this world, and karma is the way to get attached to this world, you are acting and you're getting some pleasure from the action. And because you get some pleasure, you want to repeat this action again and again and again. You get addicted to the same very action. This is the way how addictions work in this world. People take little drug. And initially it's horrible. It tastes bad. It's horrible. But then somehow or other little pleasure is there and they get addicted. And they become drunker. They become chain smokers. They become what not. You know, but this is actually the way of karma, because karma is attaching one and more or less makes one into a slave. People become slaves of their habits. People become slaves of their little happiness. And they're repeating the same action again and again and again. Krishna says in this chapter that he is samsparshaja bhoga dukkhayona evate. If somebody is addicted to these pleasures, dukkhayona evate, he thinks that this is the pleasure, he thinks this is the happiness. But Krishna says, dukkhayona, this is the source or the reason, the cause of unhappiness, of dukkha. The great Gautama Rishi, the author of Nyaya Sutra, while studying the nature of suffering, he lists the causes of suffering, and he says the kleshas are there, the internal reasons for suffering, the external reasons for suffering is there. He lists 21 reasons for suffering. And the last one is suffering itself. He says that suffering is the cause for suffering. But the one before last is happiness. He says the happiness is the reason for suffering. Because when you're happy, you get attached. And when you get attached and then you lose this happiness, then you become even more miserable. And therefore, Krishna says, atyanta vanta kaunteya, because this kind of happiness has beginning and end. Na tesu ramate buddha. If somebody is really intelligent, if he is Buddha, he doesn't really derive so much pleasure from it. He wants to be detached. And Krishna is teaching in this chapter this very interesting science of how to be detached and how to be happy through detachment. Because actually it is this trick of how to be happy. Krishna gives an example of the lotus leaf. He says that the lotus leaf is there in the water, but it doesn't really get wet. It's in the water, but it's beyond the water. And he says at the same time, if somebody has his consciousness beyond the matter, if somebody doesn't allow his consciousness to be sucked into this whirlpool of material energy, if somebody keeps little away from this material energy, doesn't allow his consciousness to be overwhelmed by the passions, by ignorance of material nature, then he is happy. He is happy even though he is living in this world. He is like this lotus leaf. He is living within this world, but his consciousness is beyond this world. And Krishna is explaining the way how to detach oneself, because it's not so easy. It's a science. It's a great science. And of course, the great rishis and the great munis of the past, they perfected this science. And Prabhupada mentions this, that this particular chapter deals with the concept of sakshi, or observer. What exactly Krishna is recommending to us, he says, the way not to be detached, not to be too attached, is always to remain who you are. And who we are not the doers. It's just an illusion. It seems to us that we are the doers. It seems to us that everything depends on us, how expert we are, how active we are, this and that. But there are so many other factors involved. And in reality, the soul always remains the observer. The real position of the soul is to observe. They observe one's own nature. They observe the happenings of this world. Not to get too absorbed in this world. You know, you just observe. And this is actually a very great secret. Because when you observe something, you can be happy no matter how horrible it is. And the example is that people go to see the movies. And sometimes, or oftentimes, the movies are horrible. There are so many different horrible things, horror movies, right? And people are sitting there, they're going there, they're paying money to see all these horrors. Because when they're observers, they're happy. Even though what they observe is not nice. But still they're happy because they're observers. They're beyond what is happening. They're just observing it and they're saying, this is nice, interesting, you know, it's funny, you know, it's exciting. But if you offer to them, would you like to be in this particular situation yourself? They will say, no, no, I don't want. I want just to sit and watch. But in reality, that's exactly what Krishna is suggesting in this chapter. He says, you become the observer. So many different things will happen to you. So many difficulties will come to you. So many problems you will encounter. So many sufferings will be there. But if you're a little detached, you just absorb it. And then you're not so unhappy. You're not so miserable because you're not so attached. You're just absorbing it and you're saying, yes, it's fine. And ultimately you keep your consciousness beyond everything which is happening with you. You keep your consciousness somewhere up there with the Lord. And you're observing what is happening. And you know that this is just Leela. You know, there's something is happening with you, you know. You know your chart, you know, and a chart, it is supposed to happen. You know that this is, you know, and you're not that desperate. But when you don't have this alternative. When you are too attached, when you are absorbed in this, in the whirlpool of these happenings of material nature, and you have no alternative, you have no higher point of view, vantage point, then you're lost. So many people, they commit suicide, they do so many horrible things being in this particular situation. But when you keep little detached, then it's kind of even pleasurable, it's interesting. Like today, I had a great fortune to see Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, and he is in his last stage of life. He is dying. He is dying from cancer. He probably has only a few days to remain. But at the same time, he is so happy. He is in a complete, total pain. Physically, he's suffering. But at the same time, his consciousness is not there in the sufferings. His consciousness is beyond this. He can observe his psychological reactions. He can observe whatever is happening within his heart. But at the same time, he is not there. And therefore, you can see he is effulgent. He is so brilliant, you know. He's really in a very sublime state of consciousness. I've never seen somebody, when somebody is dying, you know, he's in agony. He doesn't know what to do. Everything is finished, you know, all his plans and everything. But here he is, somebody who is in the very last stage of his life. And he's there, but he's only thinking about Prabhupada, he's only thinking about Krishna, and he's only thinking about other people and not thinking about his own sufferings. And that's exactly what Krishna is teaching here in this chapter. He says, you can be in this world, but at the same time, your consciousness doesn't have to be in this world. Your consciousness can be beyond. Your consciousness can always be with Krishna. And in one of the previous verses, he says, Brahma Nirvana Richati. In this sublime state of consciousness, you attain Brahma Nirvana. You attain state of spiritual consciousness. Your consciousness is not material anymore. And Krishna purposefully he gives a technique for this which is not very practical. In this particular chapter he explains the technique, and Prabhupada mentions it in his purport to this verse, the technique of Ashtanga Yoga. Yam, Niyam, Asan, Pranayam. Which is a very difficult technique. It definitely works. It's a perfect technique. It's very scientific technique. Yam, niyam, asan, pranayam, pratyahar, dhyan, samadhi. All these stages one can go. But who can do it? You know, I cannot do it. You cannot do it. You cannot go to Himalayas. You cannot sit all day long. You know, it takes time. And we have so many different obligations, we have so many different duties, we have our families, we have this and that. Well, of course, I don't have family, but still, I have my duties. I have greater family. I have so many people who are dependent on me, too. Yogis are trying to do it, the same state of consciousness they're trying to achieve by some somewhat artificial means. Because it is artificial. To get yourself detached, you detach yourself physically. You go to a secluded place, you totally, completely cut off all your relationship, you are afraid even to act in this world, not to be entangled in this world. You are doing all these difficult techniques, you know, you breathe this and breathe that, ida sushumna pingala, this and that, this chakra, that chakra, you meditate. And this works, there is no doubt about it. Yogis become very happy by doing this practice. They become very pure, very detached, very powerful too. They develop so many different siddhis and so on and so forth. But it's only for a few people. It's not for each and every person. But there has to be the way for shanti for everyone. You know, this word shanti is very famous in Vedic tradition. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. You know, the Shanti Pathar. Each and every Veda has its own Shanti Pathar, its own mantra, which invokes peace. And it's being invoked three times, because there are three types of miseries. Adi Bhautika, Adi Daivika, and the Atyatmika kleshas. All these kleshas are there. The kleshas are the miseries or sufferings which is coming from our own mind, which is very difficult to avoid. You know, sometimes you just imagine something. It doesn't really exist, but you imagine something and you suffer totally, completely. You're miserable. It doesn't exist. You know, especially this is very typical for ladies. You know, they have very, very big mind, and they imagine something, and you know, he said, he thinks, and then they say, you know, this is like this. No, they say, no, it's not like this. But they suffer still. You know, it happens sometimes. That's adhyatmika klesha, adhibhautika klesha, when somebody else is inflicting some sufferings, neighbors or, you know, boss or whatever, whoever is there, or some relatives or our sons or daughters. Sometimes the closer the people are, the more capable they are to inflict pain to us. Because they are so close to us, because they are so dear to us. Therefore, they can become a very strong cause of unhappiness or suffering in this world. And then adidaivika klesha. This is something, the kleshas or the sufferings which are beyond our control. You know, sometimes there is famine, sometimes it's so hot, sometimes it's so cold. You know, I'm living in Moscow, it's so cold. You're living here in Baltimore, it's so hot. You know, it's one way or another, it's suffering. So all these kleshas are there, all these causes for suffering are there. And therefore, in this Vedic tradition, we say, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. You know, let it be peace, let it be peace. But there is no peace. You know, we invoke peace, we try to invoke peace, but it's difficult. But at the same time, we also understand very clearly that we need the peace. We need happiness. We need complete, total, lucid state of mind where we're happy. And we actually feel that this is a rightful claim. But there has to be, and this is very important, there has to be a very natural process to obtain the peace. The point I'm trying to make is that the process which is suggested here by Krishna for the sake of argument is artificial. And Krishna is purposefully doing this just to show and to prove that this is artificial. Because when he will explain this mystic yoga, this Ashtanga yoga process or Raja yoga process or whatever yoga process, Arjuna will say it's not possible. Arjuna will say it's easier to control the wind than to control the mind. Wind is powerful, it's blowing all over the place. And Arjuna says it's easier to catch the wind. And how you can catch the wind? You know, you try it. You know. It's not possible. But he says it's still easier to catch the wind than to catch the mind. And who is saying this? This is Arjuna. Arjuna, who is totally powerful, who has such a great control over his mind. You know, just to prove how great his control over mind was, you know, how great his concentration was this Draupadi Swayamvara. When he won the hand of Draupadi by, you know, he was supposed, the condition of this, he was supposed to look into the reflection. And then there was a wheel, and the wheel was rotating. And then beyond the wheel, there was a fish. And on the fish, he was supposed to hit the eye of the fish. And he was supposed to look into this reflection. To do this, you have to be totally, completely concentrated. You know, if your mind waves a little bit, you will not be able to hit the eye of the fish. But still, Arjuna, being such a great yogi as he was, he says it's impractical. And basically that's the point of Krishna too. He wants to prove that this is not practical. He doesn't want us to practice this. It's not his point. You know, some people say Krishna is very liberal. He says you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. Yes, Krishna is very liberal. You can do this, you can do this, you can do this. He says this. But at the end he says, Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. You just give up everything which I told you and just surrender unto me. He's not that liberal. Of course, some people, they are an illusion. Krishna is being very gentle. In the end of Bhagavad Gita, he says, Arjuna, I told you everything, now you can do whatever you like. And some people say that this is the best verse of the Bhagavad Gita. I told you everything, now you can do whatever you like. But this is not the point of Bhagavad Gita, because Krishna, even when he said this, now you can do whatever you like, but then he again says, man manabhava mad bhakto mam yaji mam namaskuru. He says, no, think about me. That's the point of Bhagavad Gita. It's so clear when you read Bhagavad Gita and when you are not biased, that Krishna, he wants to make a particular point. Yes, he gives a review of all different paths, of all different practices, spiritual practices, but at the same time, he again and again come to the same point. And the point is being bhakti. And here in the end of the fifth chapter, he again makes the same point. Yatma mam santi richhati. Those who know me, he obtained shanti. He obtained peace, complete happiness. How you should know the Lord? And he says, Bhaktaram Yagyatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Sukhridam Sarvabhutanam. And that's very interesting, because again, he gives, as I said in the beginning, this chapter is very practical. In this particular chapter, he explains to us how to practically be happy in this world. He gives the recipe, he gives the formula. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada, he calls this particular verse as the peace formula. He says, this is the formula, this is the recipe of how you can be peaceful. And that applies to individually, to every one of us. It applies to the nations, it applies to all communities, it applies to different groups in the society. This is how to obtain peace. And the contrary consciousness is the reason for not being peaceful. And he says, Bhaktaram Yagyatapasam, the first thing to obtain peace, the first thing to be happy, what you have to know, and not just know theoretically, but know it practically, have the practical realization of this knowledge, is that Bhaktaram Yagyatapasam, that I am the enjoyer of all the yagyas. And Prabhupada, again, he explains it again in a very practical terms. By yagya, Krishna doesn't mean some ritual. He doesn't mean some outdated ritual. Yagya means sacrifice. And everyone in this world is doing sacrifice. You know, everyone is doing something for the sake of somebody else. And this is called yagya. When you do something not for yourself, but for somebody else. And basically every one of us is doing this. We are doing this for our children, we are doing this for our grandchildren, we are doing this for that purpose, for our, you know, great homeland, for whatever. So many people do so many different sacrifices. But the point is that if you do these sacrifices and you don't understand for whom you are doing it, that ultimately, the ultimate enjoyer who has to enjoy all these sacrifices is the Lord, then you will be unhappy, then you will be frustrated. So many times it happens, especially in the modern society, that the parents are taking care of the children. And this is a great sacrifice. You know, the mother, she has so many sleepless nights, she has to breastfeed the baby, you know, take care of the baby, you know, take the diapers or whatever. I'm not so expert in this kind of situations. But it is a sacrifice. You know, they're taking care of them, they're spending so much time, and then the child grows up. And the child becomes teenager and says, you know, I can't care less. You know, I don't need this. And he says, oh, I was doing it for you. And he says, well, who asked you to do it for me? I didn't ask you to do it for me. Yeah. And he slams the door and walks away or takes drugs or do something else. So, and this is the way how often people become frustrated. Because they do something, but they don't understand that ultimately all the sacrifices which we do, we have to do for the Lord. If we do it for somebody else, we will be frustrated. We will meet or we will face ungratefulness of people. We will face so many other difficulties. And ultimately we will ask this question, why did we do this? Sometimes we do this, we do ask this question, why, for what? But Krishna says here, if you do it for me, you will never be frustrated. Because I will gratefully accept whatever you do for me. This is the difference between the Lord and other living beings. We can do, we can serve them, but oftentimes we meet their ungratefulness. You know, we do something for them, but they don't accept it. Krishna says, no, whatever little you will do, if you do it for me, I will accept it. And you will feel a great happiness in your heart. You know, sometimes we have this experience, if we do something not really for ourselves, but for Him, in a very clear consciousness that I'm doing it for Him, for the Lord, then we become happy immediately just from this thought. The thought alone is powerful enough to make us happy. And that's exactly what Krishna says. If you want peace, whatever you do, do it for me. Whatever sacrifice you are doing, don't make the ultimate goal of this sacrifice somebody else. Do it for me, and then you will be happy. Then, no matter what will happen, you will have happiness, because you know that your life is meaningful. When you know that somebody for whom you are doing it needs it, accepts it, grateful to take it, then your life is meaningful. The most miserable life is the life when somebody is doing it and he doesn't know for whom he is doing it, for what he is doing it. You know, sometimes people do this, they live some life and then ultimately they're so frustrated because they somehow or other they don't understand, why did I do this? But Krishna says, if you do it for me, you will never be frustrated because I will accept it. And then he says, Bhoktaram Yagya Tapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. And then, you know, if you know that I am Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, I am the great Maheshwara, I am the great ruler of all the planets, and then you will be happy. This is another cause for unhappiness if we don't understand that the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Ruler. Because when we forget about this, and this is exactly what Prabhupada is explaining in the purport, when we forget that the Lord is the ruler, then we are an illusion that we are the rulers. We want to control. And this is even greater cause for our frustration. You know, so many people are trying to control. They try to control their wives. This is a very great cause for frustration, because no matter how much you try, it doesn't work. So many wives are trying to control their husbands. It's more successful, but still it's not completely perfect situation, you know. Parents are trying to control their children. It doesn't work, you know. No matter what you try, you know, they're on their own. We have this tendency to control. We want to be Ishvara. We want to be, Krishna says, Ishvara Hamaham Bhagi, Siddham Balavan Sukhi. He is quoting the demons. And he says that everyone has this tendency of Ishvara Bhav. He has this mood of controlling others. But again, Krishna says, if you have this mood, and if you forget that I am the supreme controller of all controllers, that I am the supreme ruler of all rulers, and ultimately I am the one who rules and controls everything, then you will be frustrated, because your control will never be perfect. But even this is not, he is ruling in the capacity of Paramatma. The Supreme Lord is ruling everything, he is controlling everything in his partial manifestation. But the most important part of this verse, the most essential part of this verse, when Krishna says Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam, and this is the most essential key for the happiness, because here in this verse Krishna for the first time in Bhagavad Gita explains that besides all other features of the Lord, like as I said, the supreme ruler in this world is Paramatma. Paramatma is within the heart of every living entity. And Krishna says, Maya Dhyakshena Prakritik Suyate Sacharacharam. He says that everything is, I am that Dhyaksha. I am the supervisor. Everything is going under my supervision. But this is just partial manifestation of the Supreme Lord. But then he says the most confidential secret of all secrets. He says, Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam. If you understand that I am the best friend of every living entity, that I am there within everyone's life, and if you understand this, that I am with you, that I am taking care of you, no matter how much you're trying to turn away from me, no matter how much you try to forget about me, I am still within your heart. I am still your friend. Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam. If you understand this, this is the greatest key for happiness. If you really feel the presence of the Lord, and everyone can feel the presence of the Lord, it's just a question of adjusting our consciousness. It's just a question of kind of, tuning in our consciousness. Because the Lord is there. He says it very clearly. He says, Yatma mam shantirichati, one who knows this, one who experiences this. By saying yatva, he says, one who really experiences that I'm your friend. I'm within your life. I'm taking care of you. No matter what you do, I will remain your friend. Someone who has this feeling, who understands this. And this is, as Krishna explains in the previous chapter, in the fourth chapter, is just a matter of our internal surrender. When we surrender to the Lord, then this feeling immediately comes. Not the feeling, but experience, real experience. Again and again, Krishna repeats these words in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, yes, I am there within your life. I carry what you lack, and I carry what you need, and I preserve what you lack. He says it again and again and again. I am your friend. It's just a question of you surrendering unto me, and by the way of surrendering unto me, the question of you feeling, experiencing this. And then Krishna says, the one who knows this, one who knows this secret, Shantirichati, he becomes very happy. Because there is no reason for him to worry anymore. I have my friend, and the friend is very powerful. If your friend is Mr. Bush, the president of this country, you can be happy because you have a good friend, right? He's a good friend. He's a powerful friend. He can do a lot of good things for you. So, and if you know this, if you experience this, if you experience the protection of your dear friend, Mr. Bush, you become very happy. But Krishna is much more powerful than Mr. Bush, than 10,000 Mr. Bushes taken together. Krishna says, yes, I am there. Yes, I can become your friend, and you can feel that I am your friend. And if you feel that I am your friend, if you experience this, then you become very happy. This is the way to really completely eradicate all the causes of sufferings. Just to understand that the Lord is there within our life. And you know, so many devotees, they have this experience. As soon as you surrender unto Him completely, this experience immediately comes. Especially in the critical situations when you are totally lost, when there is no other hope. You know, when we are in our normal environment, when everything is under our control, so to speak, you know, and we know we have hot water and cold water and, you know, our microwave and everything, you know, we have our little world where we know everything. Then we don't feel the Lord. He's not there, you know. Why do we need Him, you know? We know ourselves everything, you know. We can do it. We can do without Him. But in a certain situations when really the situation becomes critical, and when we become totally dependent on Him, because there is no other way to depend on anyone else, We just stretch our hands and we say, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And immediately He comes. It's again It's a question of our attitude. If our attitude is like this, we can experience His presence within our life every moment. But usually we don't, because we don't need Him. But as soon as we need Him, and as soon as we, you know, as soon as we raise both our hands, it's an explanation. When Draupadi was being robbed, when Dukshasana was trying to take away her sari, and she was totally helpless. In the beginning, she was trying to take protection of her husbands. She had the most powerful husbands in the world. Yudhishthira, Arjuna, Bhima, you know. And she was asking them, pleading, with the tears in her eyes, please help me. And they were just, you know, sitting like this. We cannot do this. And then she went to Bhishma and she said, Bhishma, please protect me. And he said, no, I cannot do it. She went to Dhritarashtra, to Vidura. Nobody could protect her. And then she was trying to protect herself. You know, Dukshasana is about to commit the most heinous crime. He's about to disrobe this chaste lady in front of everyone. You know, can you imagine how horrible it is? Even now it is horrible. What to speak about 5,000 years ago, when the people were much more chaste in their consciousness and much more pure. So he's trying to disrobe her, and still she's trying to protect her own sari. And she's, you know, one hand up, praying for the Lord, but another hand is keeping for the sari. But then Krishna doesn't come, you know, because she's still trying herself. But then she realizes that there is no way, you know. No matter how much I hold for my sari, he is much more stronger. So then she raises both the hands and she says, so, hey Krishna, hey Govinda. And then he comes. Immediately, in this very moment, he comes. And she says, hey, far out. You know, I have so much sari. Sari has become such a long thing. You cannot do anything. So, but this is the practical experience, and that's exactly what Krishna says. If you have this practical experience, if you remember about this, if your consciousness is fixed in this understanding, that there is somebody who accepts all our sacrifices, that there is somebody who is ruling and who is controlling everything, and we don't have to worry about this so much because he's in control. And if we know that there is a good friend within our heart, who is taking care of us. Immediately when we fix in this consciousness, and Prabhupada is explaining that this is Krishna consciousness. This is the way to be Krishna conscious, is to be conscious that there is God and that He is a person. He is active. He is actively involved. He is our friend. If you know this, Gatvamam Shanti Richati, you become happy. You become very happy. No matter what happens with you, you may have horrible experiences in your life, you become very happy because you look and everything, immediately you become the observer. I started explaining this verse from this point of observer, of sakshi. When you are not really absorbed in the happenings of your life, but when you have the vantage point, basically Krishna consciousness means you're looking at your life from another perspective. You're not looking in your life from the perspective of your limited existence. You're looking at your life from the high position of Krishna. Krishna is the Lord. He is the controller. He is the one who arranges everything. Why do I have to worry? That's not my problem. That's his problem. You know? Let him deal with it. I'm there. I'm trying to fulfill. I'm his servant. I'm doing my duty, and that's his duty to protect me. I'm doing my duty, and he has to do something else too. So, if we have this perspective, then Krishna says you become happy. Krishna says you become not just happy, you become very happy. You become liberated. You become completely free, even within this world. And you don't create any karma, you don't create any entanglement for you, and you become totally happy living in this world, and you become very happy when you passing away from this world and going to the higher destination. So this is how Prabhupada explains this peace formula, how to become peaceful in this world, how to become peaceful individually and happy individually, how to become peaceful in our family environment, how to become peaceful as a nation, as a community, just to know that there is God. And we don't have to worry. We have to look at everything from His point of view. And this is, of course, the great secret and the great teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Okay. Thank you very much. So this is a little explanation. I'm coming from Russia, and in Russia we have plenty of chances not to be too much attached to this material situation, because the material situation is too horrible to be attached to it. So we have a practical experience of this. So we are now trying to build a big temple in Moscow, and so many problems are there. These people are against this, government is against it, the church is against it, you know, this and that. So to remain peaceful in this situation, you have to be really Krishna conscious. Mm-hmm. This is the only way to remain peaceful. Yes?
What's your progress of temple in Moscow?
It's actually... there is a good progress. For more than 1 year, for 1.5 years, we have been struggling, because initially the mayor of Moscow gave us the land. But his reason for giving us the land was that we had another temple in Moscow, but they wanted to kick us out from this temple. So they said, you leave this temple and we will give you a very good piece of land. They gave us a very good piece of land. But then they changed their minds. You know, we left another temple and we moved to this piece of land, and they started dragging and making so many obstacles for us. And the church became very much upset with us. They started making protests and demonstrations and this and that. And it was very uncertain for a long time. And at one point, it was almost hopeless. We saw that there is no hope because everyone is against us. We don't have so much support. In the meantime, in India, there was a change of government. Before, Atal Bihari Vajpayee was so much behind us, and now there is, you know, Sonia Gandhi. She doesn't care so much about some, you know, Hare Krishnas in Moscow. So it was very difficult. But then Krishna says, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, I am the ruler, I am the controller, I am controlling everything. So much so, it was so difficult, that so much so that somebody asked the mayor of Moscow, why in the world did you give to this Hare Krishnas this piece of land? And the mayor of Moscow said, I don't know why. I don't know myself. So from the very beginning it was something mysterious, because they gave us the plot of land which is worth of between $15 and $20 million, and they gave it for free. This is the market value of this piece of land in the very center of Moscow. They gave it for free. And then when somebody asked the mayor, why did you do this, he said, I can't figure it out. Why did I do it myself? So they wanted to reverse the decision. They wanted to take it back, and there were so many powerful forces behind this. They wanted to take it back. But just before I came here to America, somehow or other, the whole situation seemingly, apparently resolved. The planning committee signed the paper and they said, go ahead, please build a temple. And the local authorities, they're saying, yes, 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 go ahead. And nobody again can understand why this happened. It's just very recent development, you know. Then apparently we have a green light, and it means that within a matter of months we will start construction of the temple. So
what about your old temple? That you
the old temple they demolished.
Sold it.
No, see, that was a rented building. Technically speaking, we didn't have a legal rights for this building, but okay. We stayed there in this building for 14 years. And the government, We did have moral rights for this building because we stayed there for so long. So the government, they said, okay, you give us this old building and we'll give you something in exchange. But they wanted to trick us, but somehow or other Krishna tricked them. So it's much more tricky than them. So there is a good progress. There is it's going on in a very strong way. Hopefully, you know, within a few months we will start construction. There are so many people coming. There is a great deal of interest. So many Russian people are coming. Every Sunday we have between 800 and 1,000 people coming for our program. And it's mostly Russians.
So you say to the land. So
yeah, they're coming to the land. We don't have anything. We put some kind of tent there.
Oh,
and they're coming to this tent in the land.
So
we don't have a temple.
Cold in the
no, it's just the land and big tent. We put a huge tent there and we have programs. We distribute prasadam and so many people come every Sunday. And not every Sunday, every day basically. So many people come to the temple.
So the freedom of religion is there in Russia these days?
Kind of. You know, Russia is... it's not so simple.
Are there any restrictions on religion?
Officially not. Officially not. But see, still the government very much supports only one church. This is Russian Orthodox Church. They're trying to support this. Like, for example, in Moscow, there are 600 churches. 600, and they are building new and new and new and new. And we wanted to build just one temple, and the Russian Orthodox Church started making so much noise, you know, they cannot build a temple. And the government kind of quietly were backing the church. So, officially, from the constitutional point of view, from the strict legal point of view, there is a freedom of religion, yes. And we have equal rights. Basically, we have the same religious status as Russian Orthodox Church. Hare Krishnas have exactly the same status. We are accepted religion in Russia. And there are so many good people who support us too, who support this principle of the freedom of religion. There are many people, especially in Moscow, there are many. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle. But it's a nice struggle, especially if you're not too attached. You're a little detached.
You mentioned in your speech that ladies have a problem. They think different, you know, some statements. I'm not going to repeat it. How do you think they can resolve this issue in their brain?
See, it's just differently made. The man's psychology and male psychology and female psychology is different. There is an explanation to this. We have two parts of the brain, right? The left part and the right part.
Right.
And the left part is for rational thinking and the left part for emotional thinking. So the male, the male's brain, it's either one part of the brain works or another. It really depends.
Which side of the brain male has?
No, it really depends. It really depends. You know, sometimes man can be very rational. But then, somehow or other,
in general,
it's...
I'm saying, in the brain portion...
The left...
I'm a science student, so I'm just saying...
The left brain is rational brain. Left brain is the rational brain. And right brain is emotional brain.
Mm-hmm.
Irrational or emotional.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you... Sorry. Okay, you explain. Yeah, I have one question. What part of the brain was working at that time when Draupadi was brought in the court and Bhishma Pitamaha was quiet and...
We didn't make investigation yet. We didn't put some electrodes in her brain at that time. Now let me explain. It's actually interesting because when the man thinks, he either thinks by the left brain or by the right brain. Either he is very rational, or when he loses his rationality, he becomes totally emotional. And we can see this when somebody, when the man gets degraded, he gets really degraded. He goes down and down and down because his rational brain doesn't work anymore, and he becomes really desperate, and he gets into total, complete, you know, degradation, so to speak, mode. But the female brain, it's always both parts are always working at the same time. So it has advantages and disadvantages. It's not that one is better than another. Advantage of the male situation is that, you know, he can become very rational in different situations. Ladies, they always both rational and emotional. They cannot divorce rationale from emotions. It's always mixed, you know. And therefore it's so difficult sometimes to understand each other. But at the same time, the strong part of the female way of thinking or female psychology is that, you know, it never gets too much into one side or another side. Sometimes men become very dry. They're just rational. When they become emotional, they become so emotional, you cannot deal with this anymore, you know. And the ladies, they're at the same time emotional and rational. So, you know, and because they're at the same time emotional and rational, from strictly rational point of view, it's difficult to understand because it's never strictly rational. It's always mixed. But it has a very strong point because the ladies, they always has this, you know, this kind of emotion involved in everything, and they're never dry and they're much more emotional. So basically these two, if they work together, it's a very good combination because the ladies, they have to give emotional protection to the men, and the men have to give rational protection to the ladies. If this works properly, then it works. But it doesn't work all the time because we have the tendency, there is this Sanskrit saying, Atma van manyate jagat. It means that you think that everyone is like you. That there is the tendency of to look at everyone and to judge everyone according to your own understanding. So the man is looking at ladies and cannot understand how the lady thinks, and the lady looks at man and they cannot understand how he thinks because it's just different. So there is this difference in psychology and has to be recognized accordingly, and it has to be dealt in a proper way. Regarding your question about Draupadi, which part of the brain was working, actually bhakti is all about emotions. Bhakti is emotion. But at the same time, it has a great deal of philosophy behind this. And the real bhakti, when it's just emotion, it's not good. Prabhupada used to say, mental speculation, you know, if you're just, it's just a theory. If you're just philosophizing something, it's just a theory. It's useless. It's dry. Or religion, he says, if it's only emotions, it's also not so valuable. There has to be the synthesis between the emotion and the philosophy, between rational and irrational. There has to be a complete, total synthesis. And the synthesis is achieved by this. You have to have very strong philosophical basis. You have to have very strong rational basis. Bhagavad Gita is very rational. But this rational basis for bhakti, you have to really firmly establish your faith in God on a rational basis. But at the same time, you have to understand that ultimately the faith is irrational. And ultimately the emotions are irrational, but they are rectified only when there is a very strong rational basis for this. So basically that's what is being explained by Krishna here. So the real bhakti, and Draupadi is definitely an example of real bhakti, is a synthesis of both. It's never one or another. So it's both parts of the brain have to work. The emotions have to be there, but the rationale have to be there as well.
I still don't understand why Bhishma Pitamah kept quiet.
Well, he didn't keep quiet. His answer was, she asked him, am I a slave or not? And her question was very grave and reasonable, because she said, first, my husband lost himself. Right? He put himself at a stake and he lost it. And then he said, I still have my wife, so my wife is next. And she was arguing that he couldn't do this because he has already lost himself, so he couldn't put me. So she was asking Bhishma, am I a slave or not? And actually, at this point, there has to be heart working. You know, you see the lady, and she's innocent. She's totally innocent. She has the tears in her eyes. And the real Kshatriya, who has this protection spirit, he would say, yes, I protect you no matter who you are. I will not allow these guys to do this crime to you. But Bhishma said from the state, you know, Dharma is so intricate and so difficult, you know, it's difficult to say. From your point of view, yes, he couldn't really lose you because he has already lost himself. But at the same time, the wife is always the property of the husband. Therefore, even when he lost himself, he could put you and, you know, so I cannot judge. His mistake was, this was not really a mistake, it's just a lila of the Lord, basically. The Lord wanted to show certain things. The Lord wanted to prove that, you know, when you judge Dharma, it's not only strictly rational. You also have to really have another criteria or another value. You have somebody who is a devotee in front of you, and she is asking for your protection. You have to protect her. This is the highest Dharma. It's not just this intricacies of this law or that law. This is the highest Dharma. And Krishna wanted to show that this is how Dharma should be judged. Dharma is not the intricacies of the letter of the law. You have to understand the spirit of the law. And the spirit of the law is that, you know, you have to protect innocent. You have to act as a bhakta, basically. And he wanted to illustrate this, and therefore this lila took place. Bhishma couldn't protect her, therefore he was killed in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. That was the reason, because that was a great offense on his side. But Bhishma is a great person, so we are not to judge. It's just a lila of the Lord.
No, I am not judging. I just want you to understand why he
did. Why? It's a lila. It's lila.
No, we cannot leave everything on Krishna, that people commit crime. It is God's will and we should not do anything. It is not the thing. This is what I don't understand. That's why I asked you this question. She was treated as a commodity.
We will never completely understand the workings of the Lord. It's not possible. Our brain is too small for this. You know, we can explain it this way or that way, but we will never understand it just by logical capacity. But we can understand it by heart. You know, if we have the great love for God, this is the main point. Logically, we cannot understand everything. This world is so intricate. And Krishna himself says, you will never understand the intricacies of karma. You will never understand how it works. You will never understand this. You know, and even the attempt to understand this is somewhat not proper, to understand everything. We have to really admit that I will never understand everything, and I have to just believe. Like when Lord Chaitanya was traveling to the south, he met an illiterate brahmana, and this brahmana was sitting there And he was reading Bhagavad Gita, but he was illiterate. He couldn't really read Bhagavad Gita. But he was crying. And the Lord said, what are you doing? He said, my guru said to me to read Bhagavad Gita. But I'm illiterate, I cannot read Bhagavad Gita. He said, but why are you crying? He said, because when I see Krishna and Arjuna on the cover of this book, and when I see that Krishna is just chariot driver of Arjuna. And Arjuna tells him, you go there, you go there, you go there. And Krishna is doing his orders. I cannot help by crying. I know he is the Lord, but he is fulfilling the orders of his bhakta. he becomes a humble chariot driver. And when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw this, he said, you are the greatest knower of Bhagavad Gita. You may be completely illiterate, but you grasped the essence of Gita. And the essence of Gita is this. Bhakti is the way of reciprocation between the Lord and devotee. And if you have the bhakti, you will tell the Lord, you do this. And he will say, yes, yes, I will do this. This is the way of love. So you can only understand all these things by your heart when you have the love. Then you will understand everything. By our brain. No need.
Talk of karma. Some karma we do in India is considered a pious activity. Same karma we do here is considered a crime.
For example?
If we give ride in India, somebody asking you, okay, it's considered a pious activity. Again, here, if you give ride to somebody, it means you are in more trouble for yourself. Why did you give ride to? In the same karma. I mean, you ride to give, you don't know what he's going to do. And it happened with me here. One time I'm coming from the temple, and it was about 25 years back. I gave ride, my family was sitting with me. The guy was absolutely shaved and little luggage on his back and he was walking. So I thought, okay, he must be Krishna person. It truly happened. And I gave him ride on the front seat. My wife and his friend, they were sitting back. He barely went hardly 5 miles. He started looking for my wife, mother, nice jewelry. Okay, I start. What do you think? Why did I give ride to him? Okay, well, then after another 5 miles, so he asked, do you have money? I go, oh, we have little money. And another 5 miles, finally up to the Blair Road. So I asked him, my house has come, my exit has come, let me go. Then he got down. So same karma I would have done in India, thing would have not happened that. That would consider a past activity. Here again, I involve trouble for me.
But that depends on the person. You might have got the same person in India.
Yeah, in India you can also
even more bad right. Than that. Yeah.
Anything
that depends on the person to whom you are giving the guide.
My point is different. I'm giving ride in India to somebody, you say thank you, fine.
May not say. Maybe it's a bad person.
Questioning if you are doing, I'm not asking to give me money or anything, I'm doing a favor to you.
You are doing a good deed, but okay. Don't know.
Here we did the same thing, but he got the return, and you know, chances were there, he would have taken a gun or anything. But my comparing question is another question.
For giving right to anybody is not pious activity.
Yeah. It's not
another example. Shriyadam Bhagasi. Okay? He was a great Mataya for India, he did well. And the same activity they are called here, terrorist. Same activity is called terrorist.
No.
You cannot compare.
If somebody doing for America, then they are not saying terrorist. Then say, he did good for the India. So that depends.
It is all different.
In the eyes of English people, he was considered as a terrorist who threw bomb on the parliament. But in the eyes of these people in India, he was a murderer.
Yes.
No, but the real point of piety or impiety is really your motivation. Your motivation. The real, you know, judging point of karma is your motivation. And motivation sometimes is not easy to, you know, define. But Krishna knows our motivation. If our motivation is pure, then it's pious. If you're doing it for Krishna, then it's supreme piety. And even if we do something externally pious, but if we're doing it for ourselves, it's not really pious. It's still karma. It's still some karma is attached to this activity. So the real, you know, what Krishna is trying to explain to us, that it's not basically the matter of pious or impious. There is a higher situation or higher consciousness or higher concept. This is pious or impious is, you know, pious activities will bring you good results, impious activities will bring you bad results. And that's more or less set. If it's pious, it doesn't matter where you do it. If it's really good, something good, then it will bring you good results. But even these so-called good results are relatively good. And therefore, you are somewhat bewildered because it's relative, it's still relative. It's relative to the place, time, circumstances, you know. It's relative, you know. Somebody calls him terrorist and somebody calls him hero, national hero. So it's relative. Therefore, Krishna says, this is not the point. The point of being free from karma is not pious or impious. It's your motivation. For whom you are doing. If you are doing for yourself, then even if it's externally pious, it's temporary. It doesn't really, it's really not the solution. The solution is, you do whatever you do, but do it for Krishna. And therefore Krishna says, if you do it for Krishna, if you do it for me, you can even kill and not be entangled. Of course, he doesn't mean to say that now, from now on, you can kill whoever you want. He is basically stressing this point. This is the way to emphasize this point. That if your consciousness is totally pure, it means you are not doing it for yourselves. Then you are not entangled in karma, and therefore you can expect that you will be free from bad reactions. And that's the only way to be free, to be, you know, to be sure that you will be free from bad reactions. If you are not selfishly motivated, which is difficult. Which is difficult. But this is the point of Gita. Not pious or impious, because, again, it's a very relative concept, piety or impiety. You're right in this sense. It's relative, and therefore the reactions for our piety or impiety will also be relative. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not that good. But there is an absolute good, and this absolute good to be in absolute consciousness. Absolute consciousness means not to be selfish, to do something for with a pure motivation for Krishna.
Yes,
okay, so I guess.
Would you like to lead
Arti? Or we could just chant. You chant.